very useful.
Tim has very interesting background in terms of different kinds of things that he's done. For instance, while he was at OSU, he was actually the co-ad of the College of the Hand and the Science. Working on our research vessel for Homa, he was developing visualization software and also working with crews with districts and planning for our international research vessel. He also has several years of experience in the entertainment games industry. He worked for Valve Software, and for those of you who are gamers, you may be familiar with Valve Software's Half-Life 2 and Counter-Strike. But now Tim works in an area known as Serious Games, which are video games for scientific research, as well as for entertainment and enlightenment. That's the topic of his talk today. He has spoken about Serious Games at several different venues. In fact, he was our CISA keynote speaker, and he backed that by popular demand because that presentation was generated so much interest and excitement. He is also the co-PI on a very interesting forest conservation project called DNN-Biz. And the idea of this project is to develop 3D interactive immersive techniques for visualizing, querying, and ultimately understanding regional maps of forest vegetation, fire risk, and I believe he's going to talk a little bit about that in his presentation. So please join me in welcoming Tim Hoyt.
Let me get myself started here. Just shout out if you can't hear me. I guess there's a mic in here, but if this works, I'd rather not. I'd rather just stay away from it. So I know it's a little strange, sort of a strange topic to talk about, the idea of games. And putting the word game and serious in the same, you know, two words in the same heading like that. But what I'm going to talk about is just the idea that there are a lot of serious things that actually go on in games, but there are also a lot of serious things that you could use games for, and game technologies and game ideas. And the broad introductory thing I'd have to say is you keep an open mind when you look at a few things that I've got here, but also just thinking about games in general. Just keep an open mind. Don't say they're shooting each other and you know, firing their little virtual guns at each other. Say they're working as a team towards a common goal, for example. I mean, I know maybe it's a little stretch, but... And actually, I kind of wish I had a virtual version of this talk, because I think with all the weather, you know, it would have been a little easier for some people to just connect online. So, kind of structuring this a little bit, with this idea of kind of like setting up kind of a conflict or a problem and coming to a resolution. So basically, looking at GIS, looking at visualization data, the GIS has kind of led the way for that kind of thing. GIS is the traditional tool for visualizing and understanding the real world, you know, kind of things in a spatial 3D sense. And the problem is that the data is getting more and more complex. 20 years ago, you went out and you might go out in the field, like on a research ship, and you collect a series of data points along the track line, a kilometer apart, and you had a lot of data, you thought. But by today's standards, you didn't have much data at all. And it was data that you could understand by printing it out, by making a simple display. But now you might come back and have, you know, millions of data points, just no way to basically deal with it. And that, as that data complexity grows, it gets harder and harder to be able to actually understand it. And it almost becomes easier to go back out and just hang out in the real world and look at the data out in the real world, because that's the closest you're going to get to it. But that's not always very practical, obviously. So what I'm saying is that short of actually going out in the real world to look at your data, and I'm not saying, by the way, that you shouldn't go out in the real world and look at your data, but that 3D visualization is probably the best route to get there. And specifically, that computer games offer one of the most outstanding and interesting technologies for that kind of immersive 3D visualization, where you can get yourself into the space of your data. And I want to start off a little bit about, you know, sort of like where games fit into things. And games are a huge, huge driving force in the game industry right now. I've got a couple statistics that I'll throw out in a little while, some number statistics, but you know, games are huge. You read statistics about how teenagers play, they spend more time online and more time playing games than watching TV nowadays. So it's like TV used to be the thing that everybody had their noses in, now it's games and the internet. And they are, in fact, not only this sort of social-driven driving force, but also their technology-driving force, because think about, for example, the video card that you've got sitting in your PC. It's probably way better than some Silicon Graphics workstation that you might have bought 10 years ago. And it costs you, you know, $250 to buy a pretty decent video card nowadays, and it's not costing you $2,500, it's not costing you $25,000. And the reason you can get that really cheap technology is because of computer games. And the technologies of what they're able to push, like, for example, I mentioned the game engine technologies. Game engines are that's the software that's running on your machine that's making the game go. That's sort of the underlying system that's rendering everything on your screen. And some of the new game technologies like Unreal 3 and some of the game consoles, just pushing phenomenal numbers of just polygons that they're rendering per second and ability to do real-time lighting and shadows and everything like that. It's phenomenal numbers. And I always look back at the Silicon Graphics workstations that people used to kind of lust for in oceanography way back when, how they were the pretty cool thing. And then I think back about what they used to see on their screens, and I thought it was so cool. But now, a really low-end PC could probably do a better job than some of those back then. And it's not just the software technology, the game engines, it's even the hardware technology, specifically the graphics cards, where now you're getting graphics cards where there's more processing power on the graphics card than in your machine sometimes. And you can tell, if you get a nice graphics card nowadays, video card, it has a huge heatsink on it and a huge fan. So basically anything that's making a lot of heat is going to make probably doing a lot of computation. And you have to have these whole heating cooling solutions just for your video card. And all this high-end technology, all just driven by consumer demand for video games. All just people wanting to play games. I guess, I don't know if you can see that number back there, but it's basically estimated the video game market was about $7 billion in 2005. And I just saw a thing online this morning that said the estimates for 2006 were $12 billion. So it's a lot of money being spent on video games, a lot of money being pushed into that. And all that consumer money pushed into it is really driving development of new technologies, but not just technologies, but also ideas. And not only is the hardware and the technology getting sophisticated, but the games are getting sophisticated, and the things people do with them are also getting really sophisticated. And this is kind of an important thing to keep in mind. And I step back to this idea that, like, it's not people shooting each other, it's a group of people in a collaborative environment working towards a common goal. And I know that it sounds a little bit strange to say that, but it really is true. That think about an environment where you could throw a whole bunch of strangers together and say, hey, we're together towards a common goal. You don't know each other. You can't only talk to each other using text, but figure it out and solve your problem together. And they do it. And imagine trying to do that with a group of students in a classroom or a group of scientists, remote collaboration or something like that. And that the social dynamics that people show inside of games is actually hugely sophisticated. The way people plan, the way they collaborate, the way they cooperate, all these things that you wish, you know, at one time I heard somebody say that this guy's a vice president of marketing at a major textbook publishing company, and he said he wishes he could get everybody in his company to work as well together as he sees people working in games like World of Warcraft online. Just the way people plan, he said it almost like you describe a game and leave out the game parts. It sounds like you're describing some kind of project management system or online, you know, sophisticated collaboratory system. And that interesting thing about that collaboration, though, is that it's occurring in a really, in a visually very nice looking world, in a visually probably pretty highly technically simulated world, but all the interaction that's occurring is occurring just by people with one hand on their mouse probably and another hand on their keyboard. They're not using any kind of complex input devices. They're not using any kind of reality goggles. They're not using any of that stuff. They're just using a PC. And, you know, if you're a typical kind of first-person shooter-type game player, you know about putting your fingers on the WASD keys, and that's how you move. And then your other hand's on your hands on your mouse, and that's how you look around, and you click your mouse. And it's this extremely simplistic interface. But it's extremely effective in the things people can do with it. There's no manual, for example. The other thing is game developers don't sit around and say, hey, let's create a game in which we will foster extreme collaborative behavior amongst players. They like to do that, and they like to think that they do that, and maybe they do plan to do that, but it's like making movies. If you knew how to make a good movie, you'd only make good movies, right? There wouldn't be any bad movies if people knew how to make good movies. If people knew how to make good games, that'd only be good games. And the truth is, you never quite know. But really, what games do, they don't necessarily give the players everything they need to be able to do what they want to do. And really what they do is they give them an environment. And they give them an environment where they're able to work together and collaborate on some goal, and that most of what comes out of it is actually innovation and immersive behavior from the players themselves. In other words, you give the players a set of basic tools, and then you see what it is they do with it. And that whole idea, you have to think about how you would apply that kind of idea to, say, a GIS application. I mean, think about, like, ArcGIS, which I have on my machine at work, and I have tried to use it multiple times, and I get lost every time. There's just way too many buttons, and there's way too many menus, and too many dialog boxes, and I get lost. But you can put me in front of any computer game, and I'd probably figure it out, just like any other game player could, that you're just in there doing pretty amazing stuff, interacting with an environment. Admittedly, not getting a lot of technical data out of that environment, but nonetheless interacting with it. And by giving players such a simple system to work from, then they innovate with all kinds of things. And I have a couple pictures here. One in particular, there's like, I don't know if you play the word game World of Warcraft at all. So, I actually been playing it lately, but this is before my time as it were. This is a picture, I think it was called the Naked Gnome March. And there were a lot of people that objected to the way the game designers had designed one of the characters, and they said it was too weak. So they wanted to hold a protest. Now, how do you hold a protest in a virtual game world? This is a massive multiplayer online game with lots of players in it. So what they did is a whole bunch of people created brand new characters that were little gnomes, and they had them wear the minimum amount of clothing they could, which is just kind of like running around in your underwear. And then they had them all go to this one city and all congregate in this one spot. And you can see there's little tiny people all over the place, and they're all real players. And all that traffic is going to do crazy things to the game servers. It's going to make the game servers go slow. It's going to make the people that are trying to play the games have a hard time. But it got the attention of the game developers, and it was sort of like this really interesting example of an online virtual protest against something. And then nobody ever anticipated that. There's nothing in the manual that says, and if you want to make an online protest, create a naked gnome and go stand in the middle of that bridge and get your friends together. And I don't know, it's sort of an off-the-wall example, but I think a really interesting one. And actually, World of Warcraft, my advice is, if you're interested in how games work and the dynamics of multiple people in the same shared environment, you should play this game. And my advice also is that you should not play this game, because it is hugely addictive, and you will have way too much fun, and you will be thinking, it's only 1 o'clock and a.m. and just a little bit more, and I'll soon do that, and now I'm going to get out of bed. And it's quite a fun game. It's a game that puts players in a online world where it's kind of a fantasy environment. You're running around, you're exploring, you're fighting monsters, trying to follow quests and things like that. But you're also playing with other players online too. And you often find that the best way to succeed in anything is to work with other people rather than do it by yourself. And so you're not forced to collaborate with people, but it's just a lot more effective if you do. And it's kind of an interesting environment. You can be a variety of different kinds of characters or genders. I just randomly made up a character and ended up having this female elf character here. I never played a female character, and it's really interesting because I think it's sort of, everybody ought to play a character of the opposite gender in a game because you see how people will treat you. And it's really strange to occasionally have people flirt with me and things like that. My daughter, who's 14, I'm talking to her about this morning. I choose things to wear character wears that are efficient and effective and make them a stronger character, but my daughter says, yes, but your boots don't match your hat. You know? So that's probably the dead giveaway for some people. That's the guy playing that character because his boots don't match the hat. But anyway, I don't know. My daughter picked up on that really well. So I realize I'm kind of flying through my slides probably a little faster than I want to, but you know, what I hope a little bit that I've shown there is that, and I'm not done yet, but that there's a lot of sophisticated behavior that goes on. That people playing games like World of Warcraft will spend hours prepping and planning for a particular thing they're going to do with a group of people, and they'll coordinate, and they'll have weekly meetings where they get together, and they say, okay, Friday we're going to go online, we're going to go to this particular mission, and we're going to do this, and you know, who needs help? Oh, you need some whatever. You need some more healing potions. I've got some extras here. You take mine. Amazingly sophisticated things, and also then stepping back a little farther, amazingly sophisticated technology in games. There's a number I forgot to throw out, like the new PlayStation 3s that came out a while back. I think it's rated at 2. Oh, God, I'm not sure I get this right. I want to say 2 teraflops of compute power in the machine. Just a huge amount of compute power built into that hardware on a little box that costs, you know, $600 or $3,000 that you bought on eBay the day after it came out. But a huge amount of compute power in that little box that just sits on your shelf, you know, or just by your TV. And it's the kind of compute power that people probably would have dreamed of having, you know, not that long ago. But now it's just in this little consumer device that you buy at Fred Meyer. And actually, the Xbox machine is the same way. It's the same kind of thing, where there's a huge amount of compute power in there. Now, the interesting little thing to add to that, and a caveat, or an add-on, or an addendum, is the new Nintendo Wii game system, spelled WII. So, the PlayStation 3 and Xbox, new Xbox, came out about the same time. You look at the numbers on those things, and you go, there's an amazing amount of compute power in the thing, and they can do, you know, a bajillion pixels per, you know, rendered polygon faces per second, on and on and on, all this sort of technical wow stuff. And you look at pictures of the games, and it's like, that's just stunning, it's so real. But then you step back and you say, well, wait a minute, it looks really nice, but is it fun to play? And that's what's really interesting about the Wii, is that they put their effort into making a game system that was fun to play, and not necessarily the most stellar visual thing. I mean, it's like the games you see on it, they don't look great. It's like they look a little bit like games you saw 5 years ago. But the Wii is really fun to play. I almost wish I would have grabbed a video of one to show. I don't know if people have seen it before, but I need a demo object. You play it with this thing in your hand that's detects motion in your hand. It's not your typical controller like that, although you can play that kind of game. It's a thing that's detecting motion. Basic games that it comes with is one of them is a little set of sports games. It's a tennis game. So to hit the ball in a tennis game, you have to go like that. You have to move your arms. There's a bowling game that goes like that. There's a boxing game. And they're all very physical. In fact, I just saw a little blog post by a guy this morning where this guy, I can't remember how long he did it, for a month or 6 weeks, all he did was spend, I can't remember, like an hour a day playing games on his Wii, because it's very active. People sweat a lot, and they work up a sweat when they're doing it. And he lost, like, I can't remember how many pounds he lost altogether. I think it was like 9 pounds or 10 pounds or something like that. Basically, it was the video game diet, essentially. Not diet, but the video game exercise plan. And it was really effective. Now, a really interesting thing about that game, too, is that it attracts non-standard game players. I read a number of accounts after it came out around Thanksgiving where people said, oh, I took it home, plugged it into my parents' house, and I got my dad or my mom or my grandmother or whoever who never plays video games to play this thing. and really get into it. And that's a really interesting thing. And in fact, it's a mistake to think of the demographics of video game players as being a bunch of 14-year-old males. Because that's the stereotype demographic, and there's some truth to that demographic. But there's also this whole other demographic of people out there who play games that are in their 30s or their 40s, they're male, they're female, and they're very interested in these kind of social interactions that go on. In fact, I don't know if I call it a game, but something I call Second Life. Second Life is just a big, massive online world where you can run around and do things. And there's no shooting, there's no killing, there's no goals per se, but there's a huge amount of creating of new things and social interaction. And in fact, in that game, I think the average player age is about 35, and it's a 50-50 split, male-female for demographics, which is kind of interesting. Getting into the idea of applying games for education, if your game only aims at a certain demographic, if you're only hitting those 14-year-old males, then it's not going to be a very effective tool for bringing science and math, for example, to females or under, you know, underrepresented groups. So back to my slide. The idea is that all these things I'm talking about, compute power, you know, interactions and things like that, they're all coming from commercial off-the-shelf stuff, that from unsophisticated, untrained users. It's not a $5,000, $10,000 package with somebody with a college degree required to run. And, you know, who needs, and I'm sure some people could tell me why they need it, but who needs a Silicon Graphics workstation when you can just go get a Dell or an Xbox 360? Who needs a user manual for a complex application when you've got WASD? And I said that WASD is like, if you're in a game, you know, that's like this little magic pattern. You put your fingers on like that, and that key makes you move forward, and that one moves backwards, and that one's left, and that one's right. And it's just like this. We did a demo of our GNN Viz project a while back in forestry at an open house, and we had people come through and looking at it, and you know, the dean and all this and all that. And somebody came along with a couple kids, you know, a couple like 6 or 7 year old kids, and they were like, "Oh, can I try it?" And I thought, "Sure," you know. And this kid grabs a mouse, he puts his hand on the keyboard, and off he goes, and he's running all around this thing. And I thought, maybe it's a little scary, but it's pretty amazing. I mean, obviously that kid had that kind of exposure to that kind of thing. And it's this really natural environment for people. And in fact, it's in some respects a very simple, yet sophisticated environment at the same time. And lastly, in this slide, and getting back more to the idea of applications for serious games things, why spend thousands of dollars on a certain visualization package if you can do what you need to do using an existing game? If you can go down to Fred Meyer and buy Half-Life 2 for, you know, $29.99, I don't know what it is nowadays, but something like that. If you can go buy that and modify it to serve as a platform for your visualization system, why do that rather than licensing an extremely expensive technology? And in fact, that's, you know, segueing into this idea of using games for solving more serious problems. That games, in fact, are a path towards creating visualization tools. And it, by serious problems, and you hear that term serious games a lot lately, and I think there's different definitions of it, but the one I always kind of like is that serious games is taking game ideas and game concepts and game technologies and applying them to not necessarily entertainment-related applications. It might be simulation, it might be visualization, it might be training, it might be just social interaction, it doesn't matter. But basically, you're talking about things that aren't necessarily meant purely for entertainment value. The guy that played his Wii every day for a month and lost weight, I don't know, if you call that a serious game, I don't know. That's sort of an odd hybrid one like that. And so, who uses games like this? Right now, government applications are a lot big, and specifically the military. The U.S. military and actually other militaries are using games quite a bit nowadays for training, for visualization, for simulation, and even for recruitment. And also medicine. Actually kind of interesting. I saw a really interesting presentation a couple of years back at a Games for Health conference about even Games for Health related things. Some people were trying to create a simulator for laparoscopic surgery. And that's where you make a very small incision, and you take little things that go down inside the person's body, and you use them little controllers like this to operate them. And it's not, you know, make the big opening and do all your big surgery. It's more like very tiny, precise control type work. So they were trying to make a simulator for laparoscopic surgery. And they started out by trying to simulate intestines and everything. And I saw these early screenshots of this. And they were, you know, trying to get them shiny and look just right and flop around just right. All these sophisticated things they were trying to do. And in the end, they couldn't get it right. And in the end, what they did was come up with this little thing that basically looked like a video game, where you sat there with your little simulator, and you had this abstracted cube on your screen, and there was a little ball. And all you had to do was grab the ball with your little manipulators, grab the ball virtually, and attach it to another side, and grab the ball and attach it to this side. A totally abstracted, actually a fun little game, because it was this little challenge. It was like whack-a-mole or something. You know, you're playing some little game like that. Yet they found it was hugely effective for training surgeons to teach them the manipulative processes. They didn't need a super sophisticated simulation of intestines. So back a little bit to the Army. U.S. Army has a game called America's Army, and they pumped something like, I think, around $80 million into this thing. And basically, it's a first-person online multiplayer shooter type game where you play a U.S. Army, member of the U.S. Army. It's all, you know, modeled after realistic, you know, looking uniforms and weapons and things like that. You even have to go through a certain kind of basic training before you can even play the game. You have to prove that you're able to, you know, play the game before you can actually play it online. And the Army does it as a recruitment tool. And they see it as an effective tool for trying to put out their message. They also use it as a training platform. For example, when they want to prototype a new weapon system or a new idea, they will sometimes use this America's Army as their development platform, put the new thing into that environment so they can actually get a visualization for it. It's really funny. The military, they put a lot of money into this stuff. And when I've gone to serious games conferences back in D.C., they're very military oriented. But that's not all that it is. And it's like, I know some people get a little turned off by that at times. They got some pretty kind of cool toys. I remember playing one where they had a mock-up of some kind of a rocket launching system where you had to put your head up to it and steer your little rocket around. And it was actually pretty fun to play with. So, interesting thing about America's Army, when you play that game, you play online only against other players, instead of a team versus a team. And the other team always looks like them. The other team never looks like U.S. soldiers. The other team always looks like some abstracted foreigners that you're shooting at. And your team is always the Americans. And like I said, that's maybe getting into political games instead of serious games. But it may not necessarily be where I personally think that the game stuff ought to go, but it has to be where a whole lot of money is going to right now. So medical simulations. I mentioned the idea of the laparoscopic surgery training. I worked for a little while with a group at Texas A&M that wants to create kind of a first-person training game for people in emergency situations, hospitals, where you're trying to deal with a patient. There's a term called the moulage, which is where you have a virtual triage. That's where you have a simulated accident where you set people up with the fake wounds and everything, and you have somebody come in and they have to do a triage thing. So video game environment would be an excellent environment to recreate that, sort of a virtual moulage. NASA's actually been just sort of getting into this space too. I, a while back, found out that NASA's going to be funding development of kind of a space-based NASA-themed online game. And what they want to see is an environment where they can push the whole STEM of thing, you know, science, technology, engineering, and math. They want to push that whole thing out there. They want to push that out to people. They want to educate people about what it is that NASA's trying to do. And they even, this is kind of interesting, they even, one of the things they look at is NASA looks at long-term plans for like, okay, we want to send somebody to Mars. Well, it's not going to happen tomorrow. And the people that are actually doing it are probably still, you know, they're still in school. They're still in, you know, think about that. If something that's going to happen 20, 30 years from now, how do you train people for that? And so one of the things they look at is, well, if we get people, you know, thinking about these things now via video games, then that's one approach to it. Just a couple of screenshots from some serious games. This is a military, I can't remember which one it was, some military simulation. You don't see many military simulation stuff nowadays that isn't set somewhere in a hot, tan-looking place like that. Here's a screenshot. This is actually something I did, part of the medical visualization system. That hand that you see sticking out there in the bottom of the screen, you can see it right there. That's a player's hand. You've got a stethoscope in your hand, and you can walk around and check. One of the things NASA has done with the rovers is one of the rovers has come to the Victoria crater, the big crater. And they spent a long time looking at it, trying to figure out whether they ought to drive down inside it or not. Said, well, if we go down inside of it and we can't drive back out, you know, we need to decide whether that's what we really want to do. And I never heard it mentioned, but in the back of my mind, I kept thinking, man, if you could just model that environment, you know, with all the data you had and make a video game of it and let people just walk around in that virtual space, I could just imagine a bunch of people walking around and somebody kind of going, hey, over here, you know, take a look at this area. What do you think of that area? And I don't know. I'd like to imagine that as a bit of video game application. So talk about like the technology. Talked about sort of the serious things people do in these games, and actually, you know, then the money too, the idea of the government and medical and the teaching being used to this stuff. And I think, you know, in a way, there's nothing new about the video game technology getting better and better over time. There's nothing new about games being really immersive and people playing games a lot. But I think a really interesting and new thing, and probably the biggest thing that I think people should look at when they think about using games for applications like this, for visualization, for collaboration, for teaching tools, for, you know, whatever it may be, is to think about the social interaction aspects of it. That if you take a game that is playable just by yourself on your computer, and then you take another game that's the same game, but now you're playing it with other people, that most people will prefer the one where you play it with other people. In fact, when we had the power outage a while back, and then we were chatting with some friends, and they said, yeah, my internet was out, and so I just turned off the computer. In other words, they couldn't go online and do things, maybe not only just the internet, but playing games online. They didn't want to do it anymore. I mean, they had all these games they could have played just on their computer by itself off the net, but they didn't want to do it because they were so into the whole social interaction part of it. And really, you know, noteworthy games in this space, was World of Warcraft. World of Warcraft, I think, they just hit like 8 million registered subscribers playing their game. And it's not 8 million people playing it all at the same time, but 8 million people that have signed up. So whatever the math is, that company's doing pretty well because it's about $15 a month to play a game times 8 million times 12. So they're doing pretty good. Second Life is another one. And Second Life is a really interesting phenomenon. And then it's this big virtual world where you run around with your character, you interact with other people that are playing the game, and there are essentially no goals in that game. It's just a big virtual world. You're able to actually create new things and modify things and do things like create a little 3D primitive that looks like a hat and attach it to your head, and then you can create a hat for yourself, for example. But then you can turn around and you can sell that hat to other people. You can duplicate the hat and sell that. Online economy. And so it's kind of hard to explain. In fact, the people just run around in this game building things and making things and socially interacting and doing all these things, and yet there's no goals. There's no leveling. It's not like, well, I'm a level 30 whatever and you're just a level 10 and you've got to play longer to become a level 30 like me. There's none of that. It's just people running around. But it's hugely popular, and specifically, it's hugely popular with what are probably the lesser represented population groups that you get. Primarily older players, people in their 30s. You also get primarily 50% female, which is like, I think nationwide, statistically, video games, male-female breakdown, it's like 38% female that play video games. But then you get into more social aspect games, and it becomes about 50%. And if you're trying to push the idea of teaching, you know, to a broader group, you really have to look at that social aspect. You really have to think about that. Not just that you're going to say, well, I'm going to put math in a video game, and therefore I'll attract students and people, and they'll play, and they'll learn. No, it's more like, okay, if I do it with guns, I'm only going to attract certain groups. But that social interaction. Oh, another thing about Second Life. Second Life has real estate. There's land. You can buy and sell land in that game. And you can buy and sell land for the sort of virtual online game money. And there are actually people that have become online virtual real estate agents, because they will go around and they will buy up land from people that, when they first start the game, they buy a little plot of land, and it's really cheap. And it's like, as a new player, you can get land for cheap. And they'll go around and they buy it up, and they merge together these lots, and then they turn around and they sell the bigger lots back to people. And there's actually a woman who runs a company now who all she does and for a real living is buy and sell virtual real estate in Second Life. Because one of the things that Second Life lets you do is you can spend real dollars and buy game dollars. In other words, you pay the money and they'll give you more game dollars. You can also take your game dollars and cash them in for real dollars. And there's actually a whole currency exchange system that works in this place. And this woman is able to actually, she and I think, I don't know how many employees she has, I want to say like 8 or 10. It's a company, and that's all they do, is buy and sell virtual real estate. Which, there are times when I really step back and shake my head at things like that, and I ask people if that's really a good thing or not, and I don't know. But it is a sign of how deep sometimes these things can be. And, you know, there's a key that says, okay, if people are going to get out into that, could I get them that deep into learning and educating and, you know, teaching? And in fact, that's an interesting thing that Second Life has done, is that various companies and organizations and groups have set up shop in Second Life and set up sort of virtual presences there. NOAA has a thing there for the educational outreach thing in there. Actually, this is really interesting. I saw this morning. I can't remember the name of the group. It's a French, sort of ultra-conservative French political party that the guy's name, Le Pen, runs. They're really kind of out there. And they set up shop in Second Life. And they set up a booth, as it were. And there has been an ongoing virtual protest against them going on in Second Life. So people come around with signs that they've created and are protesting against these people being there. And again, I'll step back and I'll say, that is either really cool or that's really stupid. And those people are just... but again, it comes down to the fact that people really get into this stuff. And, you know, again, that's what you're looking at. You say, you know, people really get into this stuff. So think about it. And in fact, that's, I think, where the real kind of interesting space is you're seeing these sophisticated behaviors. You're seeing these kind of crazy behaviors. And you look at that and you say, okay, so there's, you know, new stuff coming along on the horizon. You know, NASA, for example, being interested in a game that lets people play online and learn about math and science and that kind of thing. That's actually a pretty interesting thing to think about. You know, what if you could come up with some way to take Google Earth and wrap a game on top of Google Earth, for example? You know, there's some interesting potential there. There's a couple things going on at Oregon State. The project I'm working on is GNNDIS, which you mentioned earlier, is a basically a large-scale forest visualization project. There's the Graphics and Imaging Technology Lab and group in the ECS. Chuck Sears here in COAS always alludes to things he's talking about, and then says something about MBAs, and he can't talk about it. So I never quite know what's going on there. But there's also been some interest in the eCampus people, the remote learning people, the idea of using it as a gaming, as a space for remote learning. Your name here. I personally am a real proponent and evangelist of this whole idea. And I would love to see more people doing things like this. I'd love to see something going on in geosciences and, you know, think about if the Wacomba could make a virtual research ship, research cruise, you know, game where you go out and actually participate in a virtual research cruise to learn about something. I think there's a lot of potential for it, and I think there's a lot of interest in it. In fact, when we sent in the proposal for our CNNDIS project, what we said was, okay, there's this existing data set. We want to make a visualization system for it, but not just any visualization system. We want to do it with computer game technology. And we got funded, which was a little bit surprising, you know, because it's like, I wasn't surprised what I was. It's a little bit, you know, it's a little out there. And we actually got a chance to go and do a presentation to the board of the Joint Fire Sciences Board that funded this. And because they'd heard about it, they said, okay, well, you know, we gave you the money. We want to see what you're doing. You're a little different than everybody else. We want to see what you did. And what they told us was that, so we got the reviews back. About a third of the reviews said, this is the coolest thing I've ever seen. We must fund it. And the other third was, this is the stupidest thing I've ever seen. It's a waste of money. It would be a waste of money. And the other third, well, this is kind of interesting. You know, maybe we ought to check it out. And we got there to the board, and they said, you know, they read the reviews, they saw that, and they thought, you know what, this is so cool, we got to do it. And, you know, we got to do it at least once. We got to try this out. And, you know, not that you go out and try to, you know, for people in higher ed, not that you go out and try to get grant money based on that, but I think there is a lot of interest in it. I think there is a lot of interesting kind of buzz in this area of using games like this. And I think the applications are pretty diverse. It's not just sort of science. For example, like the distance learning people, chatted with them a while back about some ideas for things. So this is all fine and dandy, but how do you get there? And the thing I want to really stress is that their game technology oftentimes is very modifiable and very accessible. At a technical amount of level, sure, but it's nonetheless accessible. Not accessible as in, like, sit down and write your own game engine, your own game technology, but accessible as in, go out and buy a commercial off-the-shelf video game and modify it to do what you want. Remember that picture I showed earlier of the ER? And that was actually built using Half-Life 2, the Half-Life 2 game. Just an off-the-shelf game, modifying textures and things to look more like that particular setting. I didn't have the guns and the explosions and all that in there, but nonetheless, it was that same game. But that modification idea is an important one to think about, because I think the traditional routes are really expensive. You know, the traditional routes that says, I'm going to go out and license a game technology from a large company. I want to license Valve Source Engine. I want to license the Unreal 3 engine. It's like, that's great if you got a lot of money in your pockets. And if anybody can come to me and say, oh yeah, we can get $1 million in our grant, in our budget to license a game engine for a project here at Oregon State, I want to come work for them. But I don't think that's ever going to happen. And not many companies are interested in that kind of thing. That you go to them and say, hey, I'm doing this project. And they say, this is really interesting. This is really fascinating. And we'd love to help. But you don't have any money. And it's usually kind of where the conversations end. But what modding lets you do, this idea of modifying off-the-shelf games is that you're taking an off-the-shelf game, you're modifying it to look like something else, and you're doing it totally within the bounds of their legal, you know, rules that they set aside. Usually with modding, you're taking an off-the-shelf game and modifying it to look like something else, and importantly, you're doing it with the blessing of the game company, as long as you don't go out and try to sell it. In other words, you can make all kinds of things if you want to, all kinds of mods and variations on a game, but just don't try to sell it. Like, I could make that for the medical simulation using Half-Life 2, but I couldn't go out and sell it. And the only way you're going to run that medical simulation is to have a copy of Half-Life 2, so I'm not cheating anybody out of any sales or anything like that. But game companies are very open to this. In fact, they see it as a traditional path for getting new ideas and people to develop new things. But it happens to be this really cool niche that people trying to do serious games can kind of tap into, where they can say, hey, unlike most modders, I actually want to make a simulation of an ER, or I want to make a simulation of a large forest. There are other technologies besides modding off-the-shelf things. There are a number of inexpensive, open source game technologies. There's a link down there, URL at the bottom of a website that has a list of all kinds of game engines. It's quite a good list. There are some open source game engines out there. Delta 3D, for example, it's funded by the U.S. military for development, and it's also open source and put out. There's some interesting things, like a company called Multiverse has this interesting MMO technology. And MMO is a massive multiplayer online game where lots of people play at once, not like 20 people together, but 200 200 or 2,000 playing together. Their business model is they'll give away all their technology, and if you charge for your game, they take a cut. But if you don't charge anything for your game, they don't take a cut, and so it doesn't cost you anything, which obviously is perfect for a situation like a university or something like that where you want to create try something out. There are also some kind of budget-friendly game technologies out there. For the forest visualization system I'm doing right now, we're using a product from a company called Garage Games, which is down in Eugene, and they have a model where it costs you about $1,000 per developer to license their technology, and it gives you full access to everything, and you can turn around and sell it, give it away, it doesn't matter what you want to do with it, it's all yours. And $1,000 is cheap. Yeah, that's cheap. That's really cheap compared to what, you know, other companies that want to charge you $1 million for the technology. Admittedly, you're not getting $1 million technology for your money, and you're not going to get a lot of help for your money, but nonetheless, at least you've got something to work from. That, like I said, that URL at the bottom has quite a good selection of different information on different ones. So, kind of winding things down. I get enthusiastic about games, and I probably go off my talk way too much talking about games because I get, like I said, I get a little excited about it. But you know, back to that initial thing, applying games for more serious applications, applying games for visualization, that the data, complexity of the data you have to deal with nowadays is just growing in leaps and bounds. It's not going to get simpler. You're not going to have fewer data points tomorrow than you want today. You're going to have more. It's probably going to be some exponential curve where the amount of data you're going to have a year from now is going to be not just 1 year's worth of data, but you know, it'll be triple or something like that. And that complexity really limits your ability to understand it and to share it, because it's too complex places you get to. And that computer games probably give you one of the most sophisticated techniques out there for being able to immerse yourself into a virtual space, into a virtual, you know, real world, as it were. And so the idea of merging data and merging real world data sets into game technologies is, I think, a good approach. It's a noteworthy approach to be looked at. And there's a little screenshot there at the end. This is from the Forest Visualization Project that I have been working on, and I know the guy doesn't necessarily look kind of real. It's like, this is again like my daughter commenting that his little safety vest seems to be very tailored looking. But I like the trees. So I thought the trees were pretty good looking. I'm looking at my clock there, and I think I've got a little bit of time. I want to run this forest visualization thing real quick. That's a screenshot from a Mars simulation thing I've been working on for a while. Just this little virtual landscape. I kind of like how it looks, so you know my background. So this project, the goal of this project is to create, essentially, the group I'm working with already has a very large, complex data set of vegetation data, forest data. And they wanted a way to be able to visualize it and see it, and also to be able to share it. And so the idea was, let's create a virtual version of this forest. I loaded the right one here. I have to do a little cheat here to get my trees to show up. Bear with me a second here. So the idea was, how can we make a shared environment in a virtual environment where people can see the data set, not just see an abstracted GIS view of the data set, but actually see that this is what it would look like. And because it's like, suppose you were trying to planning what you're going to do in a certain valley or a certain area in the forest. The best thing you could do would be to have some maps in your hands and go out to the forest, you know, all by the helicopter somewhere, and land somewhere and say, okay, right down there, this is what we're talking about, right down here. That'd be the best thing you could do. But realistically, that's not going to be something that you can do. Oh, hang on a second. For some reason, I get something that runs on my computer that just eats up its computing power and makes this thing run really slow. Hang on a second. trying to do is create a little bit of a virtual space where you can virtually run around in that forest and explore it. And although we're not set up for this right now, this is actually a multiplayer game environment where I can have up to, I think, 32 other people online also connected into the same shared space. So we could be running around together, we could be talking together, we could all kind of virtually meet. The idea is, suppose I'm down here in Corvallis, somebody else is in Portland, and two people are in Denver, and we all want to talk about a certain area. What if we could all hop online to a space like this and run around inside this little virtual forest that represents a real place and it's representation of the real data, of the real forest data, and this becomes the starting point of our conversation. That somebody says, oh yeah, you know, the hill over there, I can see, it's a lot of old growth on that hill, whatever it might be. I don't have a background in forestry, but so you're giving people that starting point for that conversation. I don't have it incorporated into this right now, but the other thing we're going to be adding is a more traditional GIS view of this, where up in the corner of your screen, you'll see more like an overview map that gives you the more traditional GIS type view that says, here's where I am, or the place I'm standing at right now statistically has, you know, 50, you know, density of so many, you know, whatever is per hectare, certain type of tree. So you can actually get to that data if you want to, but at first glance, you're not being overwhelmed by the data. You're just exploring the forest and seeing what it's like. And it's a little hard to see, as they say, the forest for the trees, but it's a big area that I'm in. In fact, I'm going to get into this mode here where I can fly around. And there's Matt, my coworker Matt was the last one to run this, so that's why it says I'm Matt. Let's see if I can find myself here. It's hard to fly nicely here.
The topography is real?
What's that?
Is the topography real somewhere?
Yeah, this is all, there he is. This is all in the Blue Mountains area, in the Wallowas. See the trees are flat. Oh, there we go, here's our little guy. Now you get a sense of the scale, let me just start zooming backwards. And we rapidly lose sight of Matt down there in the forest. This is not putting trees in at the full density that we normally would. And the interesting thing about this, though, is the traditional visualization tools for forest stands give you statistics in terms of how many seconds or minutes it took to render one frame or one picture. But we're turning around doing the opposite, where we're looking at how many frames are we rendering per second, so we can have this totally smooth, you know, I want to look over here, I want to look over there, I want to go anywhere I want, and it absolutely opens up this kind of free form, you know, flying around that just wasn't accessible before. And it's all based on, it's all just built off of computer game technology. There's no, you know, we weren't writing new rendering methods, we weren't coming up with new techniques, nonetheless, necessarily, we're pretty much just using video game technology to create this. And you can see the, where is that guy? I'm going to fly right past him, I know. There he is. See that little piece of grass moving like crazy right there? I know what that is. Seriously, probably. And there will occasionally be a little grass clump that is just frenetically wiggling like that. And I don't know why that. Anyway, that's just sort of the brief couple minute version of the key interface. Oh, the trees are not tall. You run right through them. And it's one of those things where, again, it'd be really realistic to model the trees as solid, but it would really be frustrating to run around this thing if you were constantly bumping into trees and having to work your way around trees. I think it would kind of defeat the purpose a little bit. So anyway, that's my talk, and that's just a little bit of one of the projects that I've been working on. And very happy to talk to anybody, any questions about video game applications. I also will warn you that I'm really hard of hearing, and so I may have a hard time understanding your questions. So, go ahead.
Can you measure the tree, the person's stand between him and the tree, the distance?
Can I measure the distance there?
Yes.
No, but when we put when we add in the more traditional, you know, 2D map, GIS type view, then yes, that's when you'll be able to use it, that kind of thing, for that kind of thing. That's one problem, is we go too far away from the data, and it's a pretty picture, but it doesn't do you any good without the data.
Any dimension meaning of this? Like a tree diameter, or anything like that?
We have that statistics in the database. Yeah, we have that in the database.
Not in this
visualization. In this right here, no, I don't have that in here. But that's the other thing that we'll be able to do, is query the database and say, give me the data on all the trees in this area. Then, and so it'll tell you, you know, stand size, you know, the tree per hectare, the average diameter, breast height, and height to the crown, you know, height to crown ratio, all that kind of data that we have. And in a way, we're trying to get people a little more into the. We'll try to put it in the forest first and then step them back towards the data, as opposed to just throwing them in the data and then trying to work them into the forest, I guess would be a way to put it.
Well, I can think of a lot of different ways for this to be tweaked to get more interesting. What are your top three things that you're going to change?
Other applications for it?
No, I mean, just this experience, there's a whole bunch of things that jumps out for things that need to be fixed, or, you know, like, three-dimensional trees instead of two-dimensional trees.
Right.
There's a whole bunch of features that could go in here.
Right.
What are you working on that are the next generation?
Right. Sure. Oh, yeah. It's actually kind of interesting. The trees are just two-dimensional, but it's actually extremely effective until you get right like that. Until you look at the tree like that, or you have to fly up there. But I put in the two-dimensional ones as a temporary thing, and found that visually it was extremely effective. Something we're going to do is add an addition to it, where we're able to query a database, get the actual tree stand information from the location we're at, and then render everything out just in a small area around you with a full 3D render of it. So you have a full 3D model of the trees and all the down wood and all the little small forbs and everything like that around there.
What data set are you using that has ground vegetation? The only data set I've used like this just has diameter, height, crown width.
This is all from the GNN data set, the group in the LEMA group in forestry that works with that. If you do a Google for GNN and LEMA, you'll find it.
Okay, and they have the data set as well.
Yeah. It's a pretty complex data set. There's a lot in there. Except I'm not a forester, so my background's not necessarily forestry. So. Anything else?
One question.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
I just have a comment. Okay.
Put it on a disk and sell it for $10. I think that's what we're really looking at for charging for downloads or whatever.
Well, we have Tim will be here for another couple of minutes if you want to come up and talk to him individually. In the spirit of interdisciplinarity and collaboration on our campus, we'd like to present you with the OSU Geosciences.
Woohoo!
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.